This nation will be able to overcome 4 years of Donald Trump. But if this man is reelected, he will fundamentally alter who we are as a nation for better than a generation to come. And we cannot let that happen.
You can't miss it if you turn on the TV. The establishment in this country, the economic establishment, and the political establishment are becoming very nervous.
Voters deserve a choice of someone with unshakable values who can also get things done and bring all kinds of Democrats along with her.
I've won three elections so far. I don't plan to start losing now.
It is finally here, Super Tuesday. Millions of voters head to the polls today for primary elections. Nearly 1,300 delegates, about a third of the total, are up for grabs today. In Texas, the second biggest prize after California, polls show Bernie Sanders holds a slim lead over Joe Biden. But those polls were conducted before Biden picked up key endorsements from three of his former rivals yesterday, including former El Paso Congressman Beto O'Rourke.
We welcome Dr. Jill Biden and Vice President Joe Biden, el próximo presidente de los Estados Unidos, aquí con nosotros este momento. Tomorrow, March 3rd, 2020, I will be casting my ballot for Joe Biden.
And now some of Klobuchar and Buttigieg's supporters are doing the same thing.
I didn't vote early because I didn't know what was going to happen, especially after South Carolina. And I'm just really glad that I didn't.
As a Texan, a Democratic Texan, I think a priority is flipping the state house, considering how this will be a redistricting year coming up. And I don't think that that could be accomplished having a Democratic Socialist at the top, even though I initially supported him.
Now that Buttigieg is coming over on Biden's side, it just kind of makes sense. I'm kind of hoping for a Biden-Buttigieg ticket.
But Bernie Sanders hopes to capitalize on a narrowed field, too. He rallied supporters last night in Minnesota, another Super Tuesday state.
I know that there are political differences, but I also know that virtually all of Amy's support and Pete's support understand that we have got to move toward a government which believes in justice, not greed.
Here in California, with 415 pledged delegates at stake, polls show Sanders holds a commanding lead, with Biden a solid second. And Michael Bloomberg and Elizabeth Warren hoping to crash the 15% threshold needed to win delegates. Voters in California are navigating a new voting system. Nearly 1,000 voting centers are open today across Los Angeles County, all until 8 o'clock tonight. Voting centers have been designed to be user-friendly with new technology like touchscreen computers, adjustable display settings, and audio headsets. Gatika Lazardi and Corey Mintz cast their ballots at a voting center in Culver City today.
The new technology made it a lot more feasible to sort of understand all the different candidates. So it was actually a pretty smooth transition. So
I thought it was really, really effective and easy to use and much better than anything I've ever done before.
Meanwhile, there's a ton of outside money going into California legislative races. Ben Christopher joins me now. He covers California politics and elections for Cal Matters. He's been following this closely. Hi, Ben.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So how much special interest money are we seeing in this election?
So at last count, if we're looking at the legislative races, so races for Assembly and State Senate, we are looking at $19 million in total. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot if you've been following the presidential race, where there are hundreds of millions of dollars being spent. But in these races, which are a little bit more low profile and obviously a lot smaller, you know, $1 million here, $1 million there can make a big difference.
Right. And who's pouring the money in from the outside?
So it's sort of a who's who of interest groups who have business before the Capitol and who want to have some kind of say in the policies that are coming out of Sacramento. The largest spender at this point is the oil and gas industry, which has poured about $4 million into these legislative races. But you also see the realtors, you see organized labor groups, basically anyone you can think of who might want to have some kind of say about what the laws coming out of Sacramento look like, they're spending.
And are they spending willy-nilly, I mean, not willy-nilly just anywhere, but on all of the potential lawmakers who could vote on their issues, or are they targeting specific races?
It's pretty targeted. So again, I said there was $19 million overall, but there are only a handful of races that exceed that $1 million mark. So they're really focusing on just a handful of races up and down the state. And what all these races have in common is that they are, for the most part, solidly Democratic seats where you have a lot of Democrats in the running. So, for example, there's an assembly race in Whittier, in the Whittier area, so East Los Angeles County. This is the ground zero of all this special interest money pouring in. It's the top race of focus. It's a solidly Democratic seat, so there's no real question whether a Democrat is going to be elected to that seat come November. But the question is, what kind of Democrat? And in that seat, you actually have nine candidates. One of them is a Republican, and the rest are Democrats. And so there's sort of this mad dash to make sure that your kind of Democrat makes it into the top two, which is, again, the way we hold elections that aren't presidential races. The first and second place winner in today's election will move on to the general election ballot. And so there's sort of this this scramble to make sure that your kind of Democrat makes it into that first or second place spots.
And what kind of Democrat is that? A pro-business Democrat?
Well, so it depends. So right now, in that particular race that I mentioned, there are two Democrats who are getting the lion's share of the support spending or opposition spending. So you have one, Sylvia Rubio. She is one of the candidates who has received more in terms of support spending than anyone else in the state. And she's being backed by most big interest groups, including the oil and gas industry, the pharmaceutical industry, but also just a wide array of business interests. And then another candidate, Lisa Calderon, she has gotten most of the support from organized labor spending. And so you see this sort of face-off between the business interests in general and organized labor in general. And this sort of kind of speaks to the main political divisions in California these days, where Republicans don't really have much power in the legislature, and it's really just a war between more business-friendly Democrats and Democrats who are more sympathetic to organized labor.
And who's likely to win in that case? And in general, who has more power in California amongst the Democrats, the labor side or the business side?
So in this particular race, I'm not sure we know who's going to win. It's so hard to say. There are nine candidates running. There isn't really any public polling, as far as we know, that's credible that's being done in that particular race. In terms of who has more money, certainly the business side has been able to spend quite a bit more. Sylvia Rubio has $1.6 million being spent on her behalf. Again, under California law, this is spent independent of her campaign. And so this is not money that her campaign is spending, but it's being spent to support her. So certainly the money is on her side, but we're going to have to wait to see who comes out on top. And in general, the business-friendly sort of moderate caucus that you'll hear referred to sometimes, it's a minority of the Democrats in the legislature, but it is a pretty sizable minority. It's a large block of power in Sacramento.
So it is Super Tuesday, and we are playing an outsized role here in California with our delegates in the presidential race. But we are not going to know for quite some time the final results, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's a pretty familiar pattern in California elections. And that's partly because the state allows people to vote at the last minute. They allow people to switch their parties to the last minute. And so it just takes a really long time to verify and then count all of those ballots. And so I looked at election results coming in the last two primaries, in 2016, the presidential primary, and then 2018. And it was a month before every single ballot was counted, and it was at least 2 weeks before, you know, over 80% were counted. And so I think for election results that are fairly clear, we may know possibly at the end of tonight or tomorrow morning. But for those close races, it's going to be potentially weeks before we know the final outcome.
Right. But what about in the national race, the presidential race? Do you think we'll have a better sense earlier?
So it depends, because the way that Democratic delegates are counted is a little bit complex, and it comes down to not just who wins the statewide tally, but who wins in each congressional district. Mm-hmm. And so that can take a really long time to count. So I would imagine that we will probably know broadly who has won, who's come first, who's come second. But in terms of whether someone does or doesn't qualify for delegates, if they're right at that threshold, which again is 15% of the vote, if they are, say, at 14.5%, it might be a few weeks before we know whether they actually earned any delegates or not.
And what does that mean in terms of the effect moving on in the rest of the primaries?
Well, it's a good question because it kind of depends on what you mean by the effect. I mean, in terms of just the overall delegate count, well, these counts will get counted eventually. And, mm-hmm. and by the time all the delegates assemble in Milwaukee for the Democratic Convention in July, they'll all be counted. But in terms of the effect that California will have is sort of providing these sort of more hard to quantify effects of like momentum and who's ahead and determining the media narrative and that kind of thing. The broad narrative will probably be known the day after. But say, you know, a few weeks out, there is a dramatic reversal in terms of, you know, someone qualifying or being unqualified by all the ballots being counted. That might not have as big of an effect because it's going to be 2 weeks out and the national attention will be on to the next date.
Ben Christopher from CalMatter, thank you.
Thank you.
And KCRW and NPR special election coverage begins at 5 o'clock tonight and will continue throughout the evening. Coming up, there's no vaccine yet for the coronavirus, but when one becomes available, HHS Secretary Alex Azar says it's possible not everyone would be able to get it.
I'm saying we would want to ensure that we work to make it affordable, but we can't control that price because we need the private sector to invest.
How America's healthcare system is contributing to public health problems, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. LA County has only one confirmed case of the coronavirus, but with 9 deaths in Washington state and news that hundreds of people in Oregon may have been spreading the virus unknowingly, the West Coast has become an area of concern. Governor Gavin Newsom is warning California to get prepared.
There's no reason to panic, but there's every reason to be prepared. Assisted living facilities and the like, that's where we have to be most vigilant.
Joining us now to talk about how L.A. County is getting prepared is Dr. Sharon Balter, director of the Acute Communicable Disease Control Program for L.A. County Department of Public Health. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, there's only been one confirmed case. How did that person get the disease?
Our first confirmed case was actually a traveler from China. So he had traveled from China, was identified at the airport, and was immediately taken to a hospital where he was treated.
So once he arrived from China, he didn't actually go out into L.A. Untreated?
No.
And has he had contact with many people?
No. He did not have contact with anyone, really.
Okay.
Aside from airport screening.
And healthcare workers, I suppose.
And healthcare workers, yes, who were all protected because they knew that he was coming.
Okay. And have they been tested?
Some of our healthcare workers had symptoms because at this time of year you expect people to have symptoms of respiratory illness, and those people were tested, but we have had no transmissions to healthcare workers.
Okay. And are more people being monitored in LA County?
So, yes, a lot of people are being monitored in L.A. County. There was a federal directive to monitor people who were traveling from China. So many of those are being monitored. In addition, we're receiving information from the federal government and from other jurisdictions about people in L.A. County who were contacts to known cases, either because they were traveling on airplanes or because, they had contact with people elsewhere who were known cases, and those people are being monitored.
And about how many is that total?
you know, I don't have the exact number for you, and it changes because, again, like if somebody's on an airplane, then we get notified after 14 days, people fall off the list. We have monitored, we've received information about more than 3,000 travelers and have made attempts to contact all of them. So it's quite a few people. And as I say, the numbers are changing all the time.
Right. So let's talk about the testing and the test kits. There was some problem with the CDC with the initial test kits. They were faulty and new ones had to be sent out. So there was quite a delay in sending out test kits. How many now does LA have?
Well, I'm pleased to report that we are testing. The kits test quite a variety of people. In addition, we have more ways of testing are coming online all the time. So our testing capacity is increasing. A lot of people want to go out and get tested, and that doesn't make sense even if you have an infinite testing capacity. We're encouraging people who have travel to places where there are a lot of cases, contacts with known cases, and who have symptoms to be tested. As with any respiratory virus, most people will experience mild symptoms with this virus. So for people in LA who have mild symptoms, who are, you know, understandably concerned about the coronavirus, what we're advising is they call their doctor rather than go in. And if their symptoms are mild, they can probably stay home. And with rest and fluids, will get better. There's a lot of viruses out there. But even with the coronavirus, most people are going to get better with rest and fluids.
Hmm. Okay. What if you do have more severe symptoms? What if you do have kind of bronchial symptoms, coughing, fever, the like? Well, what should you do?
Fever, again, most people will get better. But if you have severe symptoms, if you're having any sort of difficulty breathing, keeping fluids down, getting dehydrated, if you are somebody who's elderly, who has an underlying medical condition, who's pregnant, you want to call your doctor early. If you have severe symptoms, anybody with severe symptoms needs to go in. But people who are more vulnerable, the elderly, the immune compromised, people who have medical conditions, they should talk to their doctor about when to come in and sort of decide that together.
Do you think that there is a panic going on that is unfounded?
I don't think people should panic. I think we should take the coronavirus seriously. It is a new virus. As I said, most people they'll experience it as cold symptoms, as a virus, and will get better. But some people, because it is a new virus, are more vulnerable to very severe illness, or death. We want to limit that as much as we can. We want to make sure that our healthcare system is not overwhelmed. So we're really advising people to do common sense things, which is we always advise people in respiratory season, but this year especially, if you are sick, if you have fever and cough, please stay home. Don't go to work. Don't send your kids to school. I'm a parent. I know the temptation to do that, but you really keep people home when they're sick. Wash your hands all the time. Try not to touch your mouth, your nose, your eyes. These are common sense things that we always say during respiratory season. So we want people to take it seriously, but there's absolutely no reason to panic, but just to be mindful at this time. When you're sick, to stay home. We're encouraging employers to let people telework if they're feeling sick, to be generous about sick leave policies. If you do sneeze or cough, do it into your elbow, use a tissue, throw out the tissue, wash your hands, to be careful and mindful in that way.
Yeah. Now, you're an expert on communicable diseases and how they're spread. What is your best estimate for how widespread this disease will be?
Well, I think one thing that makes people anxious about the coronavirus is that we don't know everything about it. But I think it is reasonable to assume that it's going to come to LA and that we will see some community spread. The exact extent of it, I think everybody is still trying to gauge. But I do think that it is reasonable to expect that there will be some community spread in Los Angeles. And that's why we're encouraging people to get prepared, to have plans for teleworking, to, have plans in place if you can to take care of your kids if they're sick and can't go to school, those sorts of things.
Did the delay from the CDC in providing accurate testing, did that allow the virus to spread to gain a toehold?
Well, I don't know that we can say for sure what the impact was on the spread. It may have delayed our ability to detect that it was spreading.
Which might have encouraged the spread of it.
Yes, yes. I guess what I'm saying is it might have spread anyway.
Right.
But I think a delay in being able to test does delay your ability to detect that it's in the community.
Dr. Sharon Balter is Director of Acute Communicable Disease Control Program at the L.A. County Department of Public Health. Dr. Balter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, why America's healthcare system may actually be making the coronavirus problem worse. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Public health officials have been clear on one thing. If you think you might have the coronavirus, stay home. We just heard that. But that is something a lot of people cannot afford to do. They might not have paid sick days. And even if they do, they might not be able to afford medical care. Business columnist for the LA Times, Michael Hiltzik, argues that America's working culture and our healthcare system could worsen this outbreak. Michael Hiltzik joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, well, let's talk about this idea of sick leave. How many American workers have the right to it?
Well, only about 70% of private sector workers have access to sick leave. Many of them, however, can't even exploit that right because they can't afford to. They're hourly workers. They can't give up the hours. And I think we also have to recognize that lower income workers and service workers who don't really have the option of doing their jobs remotely also have much less access to sick leave than the average worker, certainly professional workers.
Yeah, so people like waiters who rely on tips to survive, it's hard for them to take days off.
Right, and they can't do their jobs from home.
Right.
They've got to be at the restaurant. So they're not only potentially exposing their customers to illness, but they're potentially exposed themselves to illness.
Not to mention workers like Uber drivers, Lyft drivers.
That's right. They have no right to anything. Of course, we know that Uber and Lyft don't consider them employees. They don't get any employee benefits whatsoever. They're supposedly independent contractors. And they're also basically working very close to the minimum wage, so they can't stay off the road. So they're exposed and are exposing others to potential infection.
Doesn't California guarantee paid sick leave?
California does guarantee paid sick leave, but it's a pretty meager guarantee. Employers have to basically allow workers to accrue sick time based on their hours work, but they're not required to give workers sick leave more than 3 days in a year. That's pathetic compared to what workers in other countries get.
So what's a point of comparison? What do other countries provide?
Well, sure. Let's say in the UK, in France, in Germany, workers are guaranteed close to full pay, sometimes 100% of pay, for several weeks in each country. They can't be deprived of their jobs if they take off and then have to come back. In China, there's very generous sick leave, which I think has helped the Chinese authorities impose quarantines and force residents to stick to them because they know they're not going to lose their jobs and they're not going to lose a lot of pay.
And so looking at past outbreaks, past epidemics here in the United States, has this policy really hampered efforts to rein in the spread of these diseases?
Yeah, I think the most analogous case was in the H1N1 flu virus crisis of 2009. About 26 million American residents were infected by the virus during the peak, and that was late 2009, September to November or so. But an estimated 8 million of them kept going to work when surveys were done months and months later. Public health authorities figured that those carriers infected another 7 million coworkers.
So that's really, you know, aside from the fact that people got sick and felt bad and maybe some actually died of these diseases, that's also a drop in productivity. So it doesn't make economic sense, right?
Well, that's right. You see a lot of that. You see, even workers who go to work when they're sick, they're not going to be as productive as healthy workers. They do. Many of them will have sick family members at home. They're going to want to take off. They're going to be concerned. So, yeah, there are a lot of complications that arise from the fact that we don't have access to time off for being sick. And I might add, the other aspect of this is that we really do not have comprehensive health care in this country that guarantees that treatment and screening will be paid for. That's going to be a major problem if the novel coronavirus really takes root.
Right. And no guarantees from the federal government that when a vaccine is available, everyone will have access to it.
That's right. And this government, I mean, not just this administration, but over the long term, the federal government has been reluctant to really impose any sort of price controls or even production mandates on the pharmaceutical industry. So if a vaccine against this virus is developed, and I think we can assume that over time there will be one, but it may not be for another year, it's going to really be up to the government to figure out a way to make sure that it's available to everyone, essentially for free. Otherwise, people will not get vaccinated, and it's not going to be as effective as it could be.
Well, the argument is that if you force the private sector to do that, to basically give away its vaccines, there won't be any incentive to develop them in the first place.
Well, we're really not talking about forcing drug companies to give the vaccine away. What we're really talking about is figuring out ways for payers in the healthcare industry to pay for it, and whether that's mandating that insurance companies cover the vaccine without copays as they cover other preventive vaccines, then that's one thing. Or the government could actually foot the bill. But to place the cost of vaccine and any other treatment and screening on the shoulders of the average worker or the average American, that's a perfect way to make sure that this outbreak continues.
Mm. Another problem is when this is occurring. Of course, most flus occur in the winter months, but this is just when people's health care has rolled over and you have to start paying your deductible all over again. And that could maybe prevent people from going to seek help.
That's right. That's another flaw in the American system, where the mantra in the healthcare industry has been, let's give the patient skin in the game. That is, let's force customers or patients to pay for some portion of their health care in the hope that this will discourage them from seeking out unnecessary care. What we know from many, many studies is that deductibles, copays, other forms of cost sharing discourage people from seeking out unnecessary care, but they also discourage them from seeking out necessary care. And as you mentioned, the timing of this outbreak is particularly unfortunate because, yes, very few people even with good insurance have hit their deductibles thus far, and thus they're going to be paying for any care that they get that they have to access. If this happened in the fourth quarter, October, November, December, many more people would already hit their deductibles and the incremental cost of treatment would be covered by their insurers.
Mm. Is it better if you're on Medicare or Medicaid?
Well, it's somewhat better if you're on Medicare or Medicaid, although Medicare also does have deductibles for some treatments and doesn't have an out-of-pocket limit unless you've got Medigap insurance. Medicaid would work well, except that we have an administration in Washington right now that's been unduly hostile to Medicaid and is doing everything it can to suppress enrollment in Medicaid, even taking steps that would throw people off Medicaid. And what's bad about that, particularly bad about that, is that Medicaid serves a low-income community, could serve an immigrant community, and these are communities that they live in close quarters. Once again, they don't have the option to stay home. So these are communities that may be especially vulnerable to the spread of a contagious disease or a communicable disease like this coronavirus.
Well, speaking of politics, I'm wondering if this outbreak is actually benefiting two candidates in the presidential race, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, in their calls for Medicare for all.
I think that the outbreak certainly does tell us why Medicare for all would be a good thing. It would remove a lot of these obstacles to getting treatment. It would remove these obstacles to at least getting tested. And it would pay for the treatment and for the tests. That's why it's a positive development if we could get that sort of reform.
Michael Hiltzik is business columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Well, all this talk about coronavirus might make you want to dart out to the store and pick up a bottle of hand sanitizer, or maybe six bottles. Well, good luck finding even one. Brands like Purell are flying off the shelves. Many stores are sold out. And so customers are turning to Amazon, and they're finding that bottles that typically sell for around $5 are going for around $20. Joining me to talk about price gouging in the time of corona is Abba Badarai. She's retail reporter for The Washington Post. Hi.
Hi there.
So which stores did you look at?
So we've looked at a number of stores, all of the usual suspects, Costco, Amazon, Walmart, Whole Foods, grocery stores around the country, and as well as office supply stores like Office Depot and Office Max.
And you found what? That the prices are going through the roof?
Well, the prices in store are staying stable. The stores aren't actually raising their prices yet, but almost all of the stores that I've talked to have said that they're completely out of hand sanitizer. So what we're seeing is that customers are flocking to the internet, to sites like Amazon, eBay, even Etsy, to buy some of these products that they can't get in stores, and that's where we're seeing the price gouging. And it's worth mentioning that Amazon, for one, has said that it does not allow this. It's removed more than a million listings already for counterfeit products and things that shouldn't be there. But it's been sort of an uphill battle so far.
Right. So it's one thing about removing counterfeit products, but another thing in terms of raising prices. Are third-party sellers allowed to charge whatever they want?
No, they're not. And they are trying to combat the price gouging as well.
But still, I just went on Amazon and I saw really high prices.
Absolutely. And, they've said that they're trying as hard as they can. They've removed tens of thousands of listings due to price gouging. But, these things are rampant. You remove one and 10 more pop up. And so it's become this growing problem.
But what if people are like, OK, I'm willing to pay whatever. I don't care about that price gouging. I just want a bottle of hand sanitizer.
Well, I think there are little markets for that all over the country. And, we're seeing people sort of set up community barters or community exchanges on certain listservs and things like that as they try to gear up.
So it's not just hand sanitizer, right? Other things people are stockpiling?
People are stockpiling everything. I think it started with the hand sanitizer and the face masks maybe a week ago, really picked up over the weekend. And now we're seeing stockpiles of rice and cleaning wipes and dried beans and all sorts of foods and non-perishables.
Have you ever seen anything like this?
No. And that's the one thing that I kept hearing from all of these retailers is that this is pretty unprecedented. The maker of Purell, which is based in Ohio, did say that they've seen similar upticks, during the H1N1 crisis or the SARS epidemic. So this isn't quite unprecedented for them yet. But many retailers are saying that they've never seen anything like this.
It sounds like what you see on TV in advance of a hurricane in places like Florida.
Absolutely. That's the comparison that we keep coming back to. But the thing that's different is that, you know, when there's a hurricane, you kind of know the time frame. You know things are going to get back to normal after a few days or a few weeks. And here we really don't know the magnitude of how big this outbreak could be or how long it could last, whether it could be months.
I guess it's a good thing for the manufacturer of Purell and these other products. I guess they're making money.
Yeah, and they've said that they're running their factories overtime. They have two factories in Ohio that actually churn out Purell and one in France, and their employees are working around the clock.
Wow, I wonder if that is a safer place to be infection-wise inside one of these factories, because they must have Purell all over the place.
That's true. But, you know, what's also interesting is that doctors will tell us that the most effective thing we can do is wash our hands for 20 seconds. And retailers are saying for the most part that hand soap sales are remaining steady.
Really? So people aren't stockpiling soap, just Purell?
Nope, not that I've heard, just Purell.
And the little wipes as well?
Yep, a lot of the disinfecting wipes as well.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Abba Batterai, retail reporter for The Washington Post. Okay, well, here's a pro tip. You can do it yourself. You can make your own hand sanitizer, and it's not that hard. It's only two ingredients, isopropyl alcohol and aloe vera gel. These items are selling out fast, too, but you can get them still. And the alcohol, it's still really affordable on Amazon, still around $4 for 32 ounces. Here is the recipe. 2/3 cup rubbing alcohol, 1/3 cup aloe vera gel. That's it. Stir it, put it into a clean soap bottle or an old pump bottle or wherever you want to keep it. You can also add a few drops of essential oils to it to make it nice and scented, make it smell nice. Some places are suggesting that vodka will work in lieu of rubbing alcohol, but that's not true. You need at least 60% isopropyl alcohol to kill bacteria. Vodka has only about 40% only, so maybe just save that and drink it later. Coming up, the creator of Veep, Armando Iannucci, is here to talk about his new comedy set on a cruise ship in space. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means it's time to talk TV.
Clear eyes, full hearts, get loose.
Oh my God, they've killed Kenny!
Three words for you. Treat, yo, so.
I am the one who knocks.
She said.
Well, today we're going to talk about HBO's Avenue 5, set 40 years in the future. It's a comedy set on a luxurious spaceship en route back to Earth from Saturn. It's sort of like a cruise ship, but in space. It's owned by an eccentric millionaire, and it's led by Captain Ryan Clark, played by Hugh Laurie.
Bridge crew, listen up. I need a course back to Earth. There's a lot of people counting on us to get them there.
Everything is fine.
Whose dog is this?
That guy died.
What the hell's going on?
Should we be scared?
If you want.
You're supposed to say no, you prick.
Avenue 5 was created by Armando Iannucci. This is his first television series since HBO's Veep. And Armando Iannucci joins me now from London. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Well, okay, so set up the premise a little bit further. Mm. It's you have a captive group of people trapped on a spaceship. Something goes wrong, and they're going to be up there for 3 years.
Yes, I mean that's it. Basically, it's a it calls itself a sci-fi. I like to describe it as a crushing existential nightmare, but with a light touch, in that it is 6,500 people who have nothing in common other than that they all had tickets for this journey, suddenly finding that they have to get on with each other for a long time. And then they start asking questions like, you know, who's in charge? Should they stay in charge? What do we do? Do we maintain our first class and second class and economy class system? If we have any children, how do we bring them up? Who imposes law and order? All sorts of things there. And also, you know, how can we survive? And I don't know where we are in spoilers territory, because we're already into episode 6 on HBL. So we've established that Ryan Clark, played by Hugh Laurie, who sounds like the perfect hero captain, turns out A, not to be American, and B, not to be a captain either. He's just a hired performer, really, who's there to provide the captain role as a sort of reassurance to everyone on what is otherwise an automated ship. And so suddenly has to find himself having to perform the role of captain for real, really, just to add to the nightmare.
Yeah, sounds familiar in real life. Look, we have a clip of tape of that, of him, I guess, code shifting.
I've said this over and over again. The fire on Avenue 3 was put out by firefighters, and the sprinklers came down from the ceiling. I was a bystander. I can be in the vicinity of a catastrophe wearing a nice hat. Anything more than that, I'm out.
Look, first things first, we need to calm the passengers.
What the hell just happened with your voice?
Yeah, what the hell?
I raised my voice.
No, you did like a puppet show, and then you did like a different voice.
Was that something that you improvised, or did you set out to do that?
Oh, no, that was locked in very early on. I always knew, once HBO said, what do you want to do next? And I said, something set in space. And they said, oh, good. I always knew that we were going to have a ship with Hugh Laurie as the ship's captain. So I spoke to him way back, several years back, really, when I was first thinking about this. And, you know, Hugh is very well known in the UK as a, first of all, a comic actor.
Well, really, I remember when he was on Mr. Bean as of a comic sidekick.
And before the, you know, the superstardom of the Incredible House series. So, so we discussed that. And then we thought, actually, wouldn't it be quite a good idea to start off as American and in control, the kind of the knowledgeable, the guy you want to go to in a crisis, and then peel that away as actually someone who's quite a kind of paranoid and downbeat and ineffectual person who's now worrying about not only his self-worth, but whether he can pull it off in terms of convincing everyone that he knows what's going on.
Right. And so that does definitely play on his persona as an actor, Hugh Laurie.
And I think also, with one eye tapping into modern paranoia, I think we all go through life wondering if what we're doing is good enough. You know, we all have that kind of imposter syndrome of thinking, you know, will I be found out for like not being quite as good as everyone else? Or am I up to it? Yeah. Am I doing okay? Who am I anyway? Am I defined by my job, or do I have other interests outside my job that actually define me a lot? But that sort of paranoia, really. And then also exploring the groupthink of, will people believe in someone even if they know that they might be fake?
Well, that's
big philosophical themes,
right?
Touched on.
And also touching on our modern political dilemmas here and in your country. So I'm wondering if you have politics always in the back of your mind, or if this was something that you just want to set aside.
Inevitably. I think after Veep and prior to that, I did the thick of it in the UK. So that's 10 years of doing an analysis of contemporary central political government, either in Britain or in Washington. I didn't want to do that again. I find the political situation at the moment is so absurd and so crazy, but also so constantly changing on a day-to-day basis, that to try and do something that replicates what's happening now, by the time it goes out on air, would be out of date. So partly I'm thinking, okay, well, why don't we pull back a bit, you know, view today from a kind of another vantage point, i.e. in 40 years' time and from outer space, and reflect on not just the political situation, but I think the social situation, this general level of paranoia that we all seem to be getting through the day with now increasingly, not just with climate change, but, you know, viruses and the political situation. You know, look at that and look at how we're, you know, can we come together as a group and sort it out, or inevitably will we fragment and just let it happen? you know, as I say, with a light touch.
Right. And then also one of the obsessions, the current obsessions with thinking that billionaires can save us. And you have this guy, Herman Judd, as the owner of Avenue 5. And he's the billionaire, I guess.
He is. And he's not so much talking to Josh Gad, who plays Judd. We never saw him as an Elon Musk who has a grounding in science. He's more, in fact, Josh always referenced Richard Branson as the person who just built up a business, was successful at it, and therefore thinks, hey, I can do planes. Why don't I do spaceships? And with uncanny timing, Richard Branson has just announced his fleet of cruise ships that he's launching.
Really?
Yes. Virgin Ocean, I think it's called now.
But not in space.
Not in space, no. But of course, he is doing Virgin Galactic. And I went to visit, with you, we went to visit the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, SpaceX, we went round Virgin Galactic, just to get a feel, a flavor for how these outfits operate, and also the kind of person who works there. But Judd is very much, I think there is an element of Trump to him as well, in that, you know, Trump did well out of hotels, and therefore thought he could do well out of steaks, magazines, universities. Branson has like bridal wear, holidays, health supply. You know, it's just, you know, you got one idea right and you did well out of it. That doesn't mean to say that every other idea you have is brilliant. Judd thinks that that is the case and that every idea he has is brilliant.
Here's a clip of him actually saying that.
Yeah, no. I came up with a week's worth of great ideas in like 11 minutes. Here. Make what I say on here happen. Who's my favorite captain? Ooh. New idea. We'd sell more steaks if the restaurant was completely red. That's science, probably. Check that it's science.
Yeah. It is that kind of confidence that these people have, bravura, that they can do anything. You know, they've got the money, they've got the resources. Why can't we solve it? And someone like Judd, you know, there's a recurring theme about there's a delay in communication between Earth and the ship. And Judd is frustrated that we can't just solve it. And it has to be explained to him, you can't change the laws of physics. You really can't. You can't alter the speed of light. You just can't. That's just it. It will always be like that. And that frustrates him.
That the laws of the universe should apply to him?
Absolutely, you know. I think he sees himself as CEO of the galaxy.
Well, okay, so it's not just the leaders that are odious and idiotic, but also the passengers aren't the nicest group of people either. Many of them seem pretty awful.
Yeah, how would you behave if you were told you were stuck somewhere for 3 years with lots of other people you don't know?
Right.
I think initially, I mean, part of the whole season really is about seeing their characters start to change under the circumstances they're in. So I think there's something, when a crisis happens, there's something unpredictable about people's behavior. You know, the ones you think are going to be cool, calm and collected end up panicking. Mm. And the ones that you think are just going to completely fall apart turn out to be the real kind of solid, you're purposeful ones that get you out. And so I want to play with that. So I wanted to start the season one in the first episode with certain people who you think are going to be a certain way. And then by the time we get to episode 9, the last one in the current season, they're all in a completely different place. You know, some have grown and others haven't grown. What's the opposite of grown? I don't know, shrunk. And so that's the sort of the kind of existential issues that we're looking at as well, is like how some people take crisis as an opportunity to start again, to kind of reinvent themselves, you know, and others go into themselves and don't, you know.
Mm. Would it be fair to say that you have a pretty jaundiced view of human nature? I'm just looking at your past.
Strangely, I'm an optimist. I mean, I've just done this film, The Personal History of David Copperfield, which has been out in the UK and is coming out in the US in May, which is a very optimistic and hopeful film. It's a celebration of community and togetherness, really, and diversity and generosity. And that's my instinct at the moment, is because there is so much telling us that things are falling apart, my instinct is to think, okay, well, you know, we are as a species absurd, but we're also terrific, and I think we have terrific things to offer. and let's just try and dig deep into our vast supply of terrific qualities and see if we can come up with something.
So are you saying that they will eventually get back to Earth?
Well, you know, I don't want to give anything away, really, because we're early days. You know, it's a long period of isolation, and the season's been renewed. So we're already in the throes of mapping out where we go in season two. You know, there is an end in sight. You know, I do have an end game, but you know, it's entirely up to HBO when we get to that end game. There's always hope.
Is there?
There has to be.
Okay.
There has to be, because the alternative is despair. And there's only so much despair. There's no fun. Despair is no fun.
Armando Iannucci, yeah, creator of the television series Avenue 5. You can stream it on HBO now. Thank you so much.
A pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for a Tuesday, a Super Tuesday edition of Press Play. Remember, KCRW coverage of Super Tuesday continues next on Greater LA and later today with KCRW and NPR special election coverage beginning at 5 o'clock. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to the Press Play podcast. Listen whenever, wherever you want at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. Go vote. I'll see you tomorrow.